Welcome to Dracena Wines Podcast. Our wines plus your moments equals great memories. I'm your host, Lori, and this is a podcast about all things wine.
So, hey, everybody, welcome to this latest episode of Dracena Wines Podcast. In this episode, I am going to be talking to people in the Hudson Valley. I had the great pleasure of spending a weekend in the Hudson Valley, and basically, I used my co-host from Winefabet Street's book. In case you didn't know, she wrote a book, Debbie G. Aquindo wrote a book titled Tapping the Hudson Valley, Wineries, Breweries, Distilleries, and Cideries. And let me tell you, there is so much going on in the Hudson Valley that you can spend weeks and weeks and weeks exploring and you still wouldn't hit it all. But in my very brief weekend, I went to a winery, I went to a cidery, I saw some amazing views, and yes, I even stayed in a castle. So I hope you enjoy this episode.
Okay, so I'm here with Debbie G. Aquindo, aka the HV Wine Goddess, and my co-host on Winefabet Street. And I just, first off, HV Wine Goddess, how do we get right into that?
Well, when I decided to start my blog way back, like at the beginning of the blogging back in 2006, actually, I've been blogging for quite a long time. I was like, what should I name myself? You know, I didn't really quite know what kind of tagline to put. And as a marketing person, I knew how to come up with something. So first I was like, okay, Wine Goddess, but then I'm like, that's pretty general, and there might have been some copy infringements on that. So since I live in the Hudson Valley, I was raised in the Hudson Valley. I moved there when I was 9 from New Rochelle, which was also in the Hudson Valley because it still is in Westchester County. I decided to go with Hudson Valley Wine Goddess. So that's how the name came about, and then it just kind of exploded, you know, through the years.
So it actually did explode because now you are the head bigwig of the Hudson Valley Wine Competition that happens every year. And how did you get, how did you, I should say, roped into that?
How did that land in my lap? Well, I started to help out at the competition probably back in like around 2006 time. And it was being run by John Huddleston. And he actually left to go pursue teaching in a university in Washington State. And there was nobody left to run the wine competition. And since I had been helping for 2 years, they said, well, you do it. I said, sure. So I was like, okay. So I ran the first competition the same way John did. And I was like, there's got to be a better way. So I volunteered my services for the New York Wine and Food Classic, which is an all New York State wine competition that is held in August in the Finger Lakes, put on by the New York Wine and Grape Foundation. And I started volunteering them there to see how, you know, large competitions are run. And every year I pick up new things. I change the way in which I do the competition. And in the past 3 years, it's kind of just moved along. So I'm just kind of proud that it's kind of just flows really well. So
it does flow well. It's very fat. It's very smooth. As a judge, I must admit, it's very smooth.
Thank you. Okay. I've worked hard to get it that way.
Plus, you let me saber, so we're all good. So tapping the Hudson Valley. Okay. Your book, what possessed you to write the book? How much research? How long have you wanted to write this book? How long did it take?
I have wanted to write a book for a really long time, but I just wasn't sure what to write. And I have to back up a little bit too. I also owned a travel agency. And part of the travel agency, I did inbound tourism. So I was planning people's trips when they came up. To visit, I would plan their lodging, and if they needed assistance in planning where they were going to go, what kind of, you know, beverages, craft beverages that they were going to go see. I would plan their routes. So I was like, what can I do? What can I bring to people? And I thought a book on traveling to the Hudson Valley, because one of the things that people think if they've been out west, if they've been to Napa, Sonoma, that, you know, you just drive down the street and it's a winery after winery. And it's not like that in the Hudson Valley. It's very spread out. And now we got breweries, we got distilleries, we got cideries. And then not to mention all the sites in between and the restaurants and the farm to table and the farmer's markets. So it's a pretty, you know, pretty detailed book on, you know, depending on where you're coming into the valley, what to see, what to do, where to eat, where to stay. So it's kind of like a brain dump.
Well, I have to admit, I used it 2 weekends ago. We, you know, we went up there to stay at Wings Castle, which you'll hear later in the podcast. And we totally were like, okay, we can go here, we can go here. Like, we used it to map our plan of attack on the Hudson Valley. So
I have somebody that purchased the book, which I thought was way cool. They used it to get people's autographs from the different craft beverage places that they went to.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Sign the page. It's like a Hudson Valley yearbook.
The winemaker's autograph, or the cider maker's autograph, or the distiller's autograph.
Very nice. That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. It's like, yeah. It is like a yearbook. Yeah,
I thought that was.
That's awesome.
But so I'm pretty proud of it. And I think it's something that is, you know, it's a good reference book. It's, you know, it gives you options. It's meant, you know, I don't expect everybody to follow the itineraries verbatim because everybody's got different interests, but it's there so you can see. And I try and give directions should your electronics fail, because
how
too often do your, you know, your battery might die on your phone and your GPS takes you to a dead end.
Right.
So.
Well, I think there's also people who like having the specific itinerary. They don't want to, what should I do? Now it's bam, 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 and it's nice and, you know, simple. They don't have to think on a vacation. So
I think
it's good.
It's already done.
Right.
All they have to do is call and make their hotel reservations and their dinner reservations. And
yep, all good.
Yeah. And it covers from Albany to Yonkers. So it's even like day trippers from the city that want to go up by train to visit breweries. It's even, you can do that, you know.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
Yeah.
So if you had to, somebody came up to you and said, listen, I'm coming to the Hudson Valley for one day. What are the two things I cannot miss? What would you say to them?
Two things you cannot miss.
Spur of the moment question.
Oh my gosh. I would say that depending on the season, they got to go to one of the farmer's markets.
Okay. I love farmer's markets.
Definitely gives a good taste of the valley.
Ba-dum-bump. Farmer's market. Taste of the valley. Yeah.
I didn't even realize I did that. And another thing that they cannot miss, now, that really depends on their taste. You know, I can say winery, you know, brewery, cidery site, like, you know,
I was
going to
say, if there's one place that you would recommend that's got, you know, because I'm a fall maniac, fall colors. If there's one place, where would you recommend is like the best viewing spot to get fall colors, like what area would that be?
I will tell you, my favorite place is Benmara Winery.
Oh, that is a beautiful place.
And you're right between the guest house and the tasting room, there's just a beautiful view.
Yes, there is. Yes, there is.
I love that view. It's just like the perfect view. And another good view is if you go to Glory Farm Winery and you walk up to the top of the vineyards, to the top of the hill. That's where the cover of my book came from.
Oh, okay.
Awesome. And I walked up to the top of the hill. They said, oh, take a walk up there. And let me tell you, I was like, oh, sure, no problem. I was like, my legs were like, oh, my God, they were dying. My thighs were killing me. I'm like huffing and puffing. I'm like, I thought I was in shape. Obviously not. But it is another beautiful another beautiful view.
Awesome. Awesome. So tell the people who are listening to us tonight, where can they find you? Social media? What can they do to look you up?
Okay. They can find me online at HudsonValleyWineGoddess.com. I'm on Twitter as HV Wine Goddess, Instagram, HV Wine Goddess, Facebook, Hudson Valley Wine Goddess, and the book is available on Amazon.
Perfect. And once again, the name of the book is Tapping the Hudson Valley.
Yep. Tapping the Hudson Valley.
Awesome.
Your guide to the craft beverages of the Hudson Valley.
Woohoo. All right.
And well, it's along the way.
Thank you very much. Okay, so I'm here today in the Hudson Valley with Victor Speccarelli, who is the owner and founder of, no, not the founder.
He's the owner. I'm the present owner of Benmara Winery.
And he's going to give us the history behind, and you need to go to the blog to see the pictures of this view right here. So this is Victor, and tell us about how you came and found this place.
Well, first of all, Benmara Winery is... The winery itself has been in existence since the mid-40s, but the vineyard itself here is known to be the oldest continuously producing vineyard in the United States. It's believed that this property here was first planted by a gentleman by the name of Andrew Jackson Kaywood back in the 1700s. A lot of people think that viticulture started in California, but not so. The French Huguenots settled here in a town 20 minutes from us called New Paltz. And it was the French Huguenots that came who brought the first, so to speak, grapevines to produce wine. So due to our proximity to New Paltz, Andrew Jackson Kaywood had purchased this property back in the 1700s and planted vines here. And it's been continuously producing some sort of grapevines ever since. So as far back as we could do the research, it was in the Kaywood family for a couple generations. It went to the Wardell family for a couple of generations. And then it went to the Miller family for the last 55 years, 60 years. And I purchased it from the Miller family, notably Mark Miller. So in all those years, I'm the fourth owner of record, which is kind of amazing beside everything else. But how I became owner of the winery, it's a very long story, but it's kind of interesting. But Mark Miller bought this property back in 1947 or 48, and it wasn't until 1950 where he decided to create a winery with all the buildings on top of this hill. Prior to this, it was on the other side down there.
Okay.
So he bought this property and he built what we have, the winery, up here. Other than that, like I said before, it was just a vineyard. Mark was an artist. He was a sculptor. At the time, he was a world-renowned illustrator. Back before photography came along, he was all those magazines, and you see all those hand-drawn advertisements. Well, Mark was noted for that. He was very well recognized for that. Anyway, in short, how I got here, prior to being in this business, I was in the construction business, and 1994, the next town up from here is Highland, and I was involved in the construction of the Highland Water Treatment Plant. And all the guys that worked on the job, they knew I loved wine, and anyway, somebody brought me a bottle of wine from Benmara Winery, and they had told me, gee, you got to go there and see it, it's beautiful. But it took me 10 years to come here. From 1994, the first time I came here was in 2004, and when I pulled up the driveway, I was very upset with myself that it took me 10 years to get here. So unknowingly, I came up the driveway, and the first thought I said to myself, man, it took you so long to get here. And the second thought that I thought was, well, this must be handed down generation and generation and generation. And then as I approached the view, I said, oh my God. I said, whoever lives here is going to live forever anyway. And with that, I just pulled in the parking lot, I turned around and I left because I was just like in awe.
It is beautiful.
Yeah, and it took me a couple of weeks later to, because I was looking for property at the time, and came back up on this side of the river. I was living on the other side of the river. But I came back up here and I spoke to some local farmers with the hopes of maybe a farmer looking to sell some property and not see it developed or being developed. So I had asked a question to one of the local farmers that, you know, if they knew anybody who was selling any property. And then I asked the question of who's the oldest real estate broker in the town. So they told me about this real estate broker in the town. She was born here. She was raised here. She was in the real estate business, and she was in her 70s, late 70s. So I figured she's got to know everybody.
Right.
So I made an appointment to go see her. And prior to seeing her in person, I spoke on the phone, and I told them what I was looking for. But anyway, when I got to the office, there was a sales rep waiting for me. And so I introduced myself, and she introduced me to Margaret Bellissima, who's the owner of the real estate agency. But she wasn't active. She was sitting behind a desk. So after a few minutes of chit-chat, she says, come on, let's go. We'll go take a ride. I'll show you some of the listings I have. So as we get in the car, she tells me the first listing. She says, I have a couple, it's 2.5 acres. And I says, oh, I said, I'm not interested in 2.5 acres. I told Mary I was looking for 50 acres, 100 acres, something like that. So she says, oh, wow. She says, the next one I have is only 7 acres. But she says, you know what? We're out here now. Let's take a ride. I'll show you the neighborhood. I'll show you the area. I said, okay. So we killed about an hour driving around. And you talk about fate sometimes, you know, being at the right place at the right time. So after about an hour driving around, we went back into the office. We get back into the office and we're sitting there talking, and another salesman walks in the office. And they introduced me. Hey, his name was Pete. They say, hey, Pete, this is Vic Spaccarelli. He's looking for a piece of property to grow grapes or do something like that. And he says, you know, he says, there's an old listing in here for Ben Morrow Winery. I heard what he said, but I'm thinking to myself, it can't be this.
Right.
It's got to be maybe a piece attached to it or something like that. So this is in 2004.
Okay.
He didn't go on a computer. He went in a file cabinet. And he's going through this file cabinet, and he pulls out this folder, and he says, yeah, Ben Morrow Winery. And it was a picture from down there, up here.
Sold on the spot?
Yeah. I gave him a check, a binder. You know, you lock it up. You
bind. Right.
I gave him my attorney's names and back and forth. Anyway, make a long story short, from that point on, it took 15 months to close on the deal.
Okay.
But anyway, after I closed on the property, I never got to meet Mark Miller, the owner. I dealt with his son.
Okay.
And it's sad because he passed away before. I mean, I never got to meet him, and I wanted to meet him in the worst way. But he was very sick. He had Alzheimer's. But anyway, make a long story short with this part. Mark passed away almost a little under 2 years after I bought the property. And after he died, he was down south. After he passed away, a couple of months later, his son called me up and asked me if they can do a memorial up here for him. And I said, sure. I said, of course. You know, this is Mark's. So they came up here and they set up a tent. They had a little table out with all his memorabilia. And there's 100-some-odd people here all talk about Mark. And when it was all said and done, they came out to the hillside over here and they had this big box. And they unpacked this box. And it was like looked like a cannon.
Uh-oh.
They put Mark's ashes in there. And
oh my God!
Blew him over the vineyard.
Right over there.
Right over the side of the hill. Here. Poof. And then they did his wife because she had passed away previously. So, the moral of this story is that when I first pulled up this driveway and I said, "Whoever lives here is going to live forever."
He lives here forever.
Mark lives here forever.
That is quite a story.
There's a lot more to it. We'd spend hours talking about it, but it's a very interesting, beautiful place. It's just incredible. You see it.
It is magnificent.
You want to use those? But anyway, I don't know about the winery itself now. Michael had told you that my son Matthew is the winemaker.
Okay. And now, did he go to...
No.
He learned
everything. We were home winemakers. We made wine at home, and he was the first one to help my dad out making wine and get his feet in there and his hand in there when we were making wine. So he carried it over here, and he's quite the winemaker. He's very well known in the Hudson Valley for being one of the top winemakers now. And here at Ben Morrow for 2016, we won Hudson Valley, Best Winery in the Hudson Valley.
I was a judge for that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, my judge there.
Yeah. So, yeah. So we're in the process of trying to revive the vineyard. There's 38 acres here. We only have about 7 acres planted at the time.
Oh.
But at one time, there was 26 acres planted here. Mark had planted 26 acres. And another funny thing, Mark wrote a book. And in his book, he talks about the vineyard here when he first came. And he said when he first found this vineyard, he says the trees in the vineyard are 30 feet tall. And in his tenure here, he cleared all the property. He re-sculpted the property. He replanted the property, which constituted 26 acres of vines. And if you put them in a straight line, they say it was 13 miles of vines. But ironically, as he peaked out somewhere and some family mishaps, and then it declined. And so from the 1940s and early 50s until 2004, he found the trees in the vineyard being 30 feet tall. And in 2004, 2006, when I bought the property, the trees was back to being 30 feet tall in the vineyard.
Wow.
Sad. But it's interesting. I walk through there and you see all the old posts, you see the wires, and you just get lost in it and wonder how they did all this.
Yeah.
And try and imagine the work and splitting the posts and just tying the wires and the whole...
It's a lot of work.
Yeah.
It's the dirty side of the business.
Yeah.
People love drinking the wine. They don't always see the dirty side of it.
Yeah, but for what the man did and what's left of it right now. So I feel I'm carrying on his legacy.
So when you came here, we have these vines. We went through the tasting. You have whites. You have Traminette. You have Chardonnay. With the reds, you have Cap Franc.
Yes,
Cap Franc.
Baco Noir.
Which I think is what I tasted this year at the
Hudson Valley.
Judging. But what is your favorite grape varietal to drink?
Well, I'll tell you a short story about that. When we first came here, we were bringing in grapes from California.
Okay.
And a really weird thing had happened. I think it was the second year that we were here. I mean, I was like a kid in a candy store. You know, we used to make 100 gallons of wine at home, 150 gallons of wine at home, and then the next year we made 11,000 gallons. But anyway, I remember the press. We had a computerized press, a bladder press, where we had the sole crank press at home. So the second year that we were crushing here, my son was apprenticing with the winemaker that was here, and at the end of the day, they didn't want to press the fruit too hard.
Right. Okay.
And I see everything dripping, and they stopped it. And I said, "No," I said, "leave it alone." I said, "Ah, well, what are you gonna do with that? Just leave it alone." So I pressed it off, and I got about 60, 70 gallons.
Okay.
And I put it in a stainless steel tank. And following week, they were pressing something else. There was four wines that they pressed. It started with Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, a Merlot, and a Petit Verdot, maybe.
I
should know this because it's like history here.
Right.
So I kept every time they pressed, I said, "Leave it alone, I'll squeeze it more." And I kept mixing it in. And after a while, it was a joke, like, "What are you going to do with that crap?"
Okay.
I said, "Leave my crap alone. That's my crap. That's my experiment." Anyway, a few months went by, and, you know, I kept the wine protected. It went through fermentation and everything else. And as time went by, they used to ask me, they used to taste it, you know.
"What's your crap?"
Yeah. Said, "Okay, what'd you do to the crap? It tastes pretty good." I said, "Oops, I haven't done anything. I haven't. This is my daughter."
Hi.
That's my stepdaughter.
Hi.
Not really. But...
we're interviewing for a podcast.
Oh, awesome.
So hi, you are.
Hi, I'm Kate.
Hi, Kate.
I'm Victor's stepdaughter.
Oh. It's holy a family
it
and
is.
An extended family.
So anyway, getting back to the one, my favorite. At the end of 5-6 months, everybody was like, what did you do to this wine? It tastes so good. I said, I haven't really done anything to it. So they decided to take it out of the tank and put it in a barrel for another few months. And then at the end, they had made a small batch of Malbec that they weren't really happy with. So they said, let's take this crap and put it with your crap. And we put it in barrels for another 2 or 3 months. Came this phenomenal wine. And they kept asking, what did you do? I didn't do anything.
Just let the fruit do what the fruit wanted to do.
All right, so they decided we're going to bottle it. And we bottled it, and we called it, we tried to come up with a name for it. So we called it Proprietor's Reserve.
Oh, okay.
And it was phenomenal. I think we had 166 cases when we were done. In about 4 months, we sold every bottle. So, since then, my son Matt has decided not to do any fruit from California. We live in New York State. We work in New York State. We support New York State. So all the wines that are made here are made from fruit from New York State. So we had to recreate this Proprietor's with grapes from New York State, in which we've done, he's done a terrific job doing that. And it was fun, you know, you taste this, try this, a little more of that, you know how it goes.
Right.
So if you ask me, my favorite wine is Proprietor's Reserve.
Wine.
Not because it's Proprietor's, because I really enjoy it. But we have Cab Franc in there, we have some Cabernet and Sauv in there. There's probably some Merlot in there. But it's all fruit from New York State, so we kind of recreated it. And people really enjoy it. We've won a lot of gold medals with that wine throughout the years. So that's my favorite. Secondly, Cab Franc.
There you go.
Yeah. I like
that. I didn't pay him, folks. I didn't pay him to say that.
I enjoy the Cab Franc. I really do. I like the reds more than the whites, but I enjoy some of the whites. It's not that I don't like whites. I prefer red. But I'll drink whites when I'm in company and a nice hot day and enjoy a nice cool glass. Yeah.
Awesome.
It's all good.
Awesome. Well, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
We actually spent the night in Millbrook, New York, and we stayed in Wings Castle. And it is literally a castle in the middle of the Hudson Valley. So it is located 75 miles north of New York City. And the castle, according to their website, was the brainchild of artists Peter and Tony Ann Wing. Wing was raised on a dairy farm adjacent to where the castle now sits. The Millbrook Winery has become what once was the Wing Farm. It is amazing to see this castle. So I hope you guys head over to the blog site for the podcast so that you can see the pictures of this castle. It is truly amazing. I will give you a heads up that it was very difficult to record her. Tony Ann did not do an actual interview. She was doing a tour and I was just recording as she was going through the castle. So you might have to turn the volume up a bit to hear her, but I hope you enjoy and please check out the pictures on the blog because they are phenomenal.
Our children came along, they became castle builders. So it was a real family effort. Now Peter had never built a thing in his life prior to the castle. He had never done any masonry or carpentry work, and he had no formal training in art or architecture. So this was a total learning experience for both of us. Now, he was a farm boy. The farm below us, which is the winery, I think most of you might have dropped by there. That was the family farm for over 100 years. This was the back pasture of the old farm, a useless pasture because there's a rock cropping on which we built. That's what put us here with this magnificent view of the Hudson Valley. Now, everything that you're seeing so far was built from sketches. There were no blueprints. Peter was not an architect, a plumber, a carpenter. He sketched beautifully, and he would sketch everything that we did. He'd come out each day with a new sketch and say, this is what we're doing today. By the end of the day, it did look like that. Now, we were 23, we didn't have a penny to our name, and we're up here trying to figure out how to build a castle. It steered us toward recycled materials. We built with 80% recycled materials, and you're standing inside of 11 old barns. Everywhere you look, you see the beams, you see the siding, the floorboards, the wide plank floors. These barns were from the 1700s. They were Revolutionary War period buildings that, by 1970, the roofs had rotted on these buildings. They were either leaning over or had fallen over, and farmers would sell them to us because they had no use for them and they didn't have time to clean them up. So we would buy a barn for roughly $350, which in 1970 was a lot of money for us. But it was a lot of material. And we did that 11 times altogether. We saved the stone foundations, anything usable, the doors, the hinges. We even straightened out the nails and reused them that were in the buildings. Now, our second main source of material were used bricks. And Poughkeepsie was tearing down the lower Main Street the year we started. And that was the old, old Dutch section of the city, the most beautiful section. And they were not salvaging anything. They were using it all as landfill for a parking lot at the Culinary Institute, which was a wetlands. And they were just driving. They had been hired at both ends. They were driving 3 miles north, dumping the stuff, using it as landfill. And they agreed to deliver loads to us in the 50s, roughly 250, but we were dumping. Seen a dump truck full of brick. It's a mountain of brick. And we got 6 mountains of brick at that point in time. The third source were the huge cut stone that surround the castle. And when you look at the scale of them, our walls are 2 feet deep, 2 feet thick. And these came from the abutments of an old railroad bridge that was 12 miles from here. Peter saw it when he was 8 years old in a farmer's field in Salt Point, New York. He always remembered it. He went to the farmer, was able to purchase the stone for $500. He took dynamite from the farm, blasted them loose, rented heavy equipment, and he trucked them here in 5 days. So suddenly we had massive amounts of stone, brick, and wood to work with. Now, despite that, this is a basic wooden structure like any home you see built. New cement blocks, new studs, rafters, plywood, sheetrock, insulate, all brand new. And then we surrounded it inside and out with the older material, giving it the look and feel of age. But it is a sturdy, sound, efficient, brand new structure within all of that. Make sense? The circle of stone that you saw, when maybe some of you came in late didn't see it, but the circle of stone was formed from the foundation of the oldest Wing family homestead in Dutchess County, which was down on Route 22 in Wingdale, New York, a township founded by the family who came here in 1632. So those stones were the footings under the building that they built. And you're seeing, as you look at them, half of every stone. So take a good look when you go out there because they're massive. Peter was afraid they could fall on someone, so he did bury half of each one. We're looking out west when you stand here, and you're looking out at New Paltz and the Shawangunk Mountain Range.
How did he get all these stones himself here?
He rented heavy equipment from, we had some friends who had a small construction company, and it was a long 4th of July weekend that started on Thursday and didn't end to Monday, and he convinced them to rent him the equipment. Little did they know what he was doing with it, but we rented it, and he just kept driving back and forth. It was 22 years to build this castle with the moat. And when it was done, within 3 months, Peter said to me, I really want to build another castle. So the castle we're going to exit this one and go into, he started and worked on for 22 years himself. He had this vision that if we had a B&B, it would sustain us. We wouldn't have to leave here for work. We could both just stay here, mind the guests, and enjoy the castle. He was right, because when we opened 5 years ago, this place just started humming, and of course with the extra rental of the cottage, and now we have the annex, which is completed 3 weeks ago, and we started renting that. Peter worked on the new building for 22 years. He did have a fatal car accident 3 years ago. Our son came home 3 months after that, stepped into that building, which was just a gutted studs and rafters, no floor plan. Everything was in Peter's head. There was nothing to go by. Charles had to take an existing space, which was a little awkward, and contrive it. So what you're going to see on the inside of that building is all Charlie's work, whether it be the floors, the walls, anything. And then he decorated it in his own style. So we'll go in and take a look at that as we travel through this tour. So, let's talk about this space. You had time to kind of look around at the stuff. If you have any questions about any specific things that you're looking at, you can fire away. This fireplace is built as a cathedral. There's a staircase within it that winds around the flue 5 stories. Taking you up, up, up into that tower, you get up there, you're above the peak of the room, and you get that view of the Hudson from up there. Somewhat comparable to the tower in the back that you can climb up in. But we don't take guests up there. We kind of keep that for the family. Peter collected any kind of militaria. He didn't care what era, what condition. He was a great historian, and he knew everything about camera, every little piece, even a button that he would bring here. He could research it, and he knew all about it. We collected the carousel figures, the Tiffany-style leaded domes, at local country auctions. These date from around 1895 to 1915. These things averaged $25 a piece. Nobody wanted this stuff back in the late 60s, early 70s, and we happened to like it. It fit our budget, and we bought every one that came up to the local auction halls. The ship is all made from pieces of an old Victorian porch made to look like a ship, but it serves as a landing to the second story. There's a staircase far off to the side that takes you up into it with a door out the rear of it. Now, were there any curiosities about anything you looked at in here?
I don't know how you dust everything.
Honestly. It is American, and I think it dates back to the 1890s. That's generating art from here. You know, it took three years to put this castle here, to finish the interior, to get the roof on. And then it was livable. We were living in the basement. We lived in your room, but it didn't look like your room. It was a basement, mattress on the floor, whatever. We camped for 3 years, but it didn't really matter. I'm just going to step over here. Because we were working 7 to 11 every day, 7 days a week. That put it here. After that, it became seasonal. It was all stonework outside, and that you cannot do in the dead of winter. So when winter hit, Peter would fall back and do things like this column. He did over 200 of these in his lifetime, taking orders and filling them. This one he did about 30 years ago. I had a vintage clothing shop in Millbrook, and he carved it to sit outside the shop to get people's attention and draw them in. I worked for the first 7 years as a physical therapist. I am a physical therapist, and I worked a full-time job just to get us started, and then broke away from full-time and worked side-by-side with him in the seasonal weather to do stonework. So that's how we did it. He would generate art in the winter, I would do therapy, and together we figured it out. Started from local farm basements, we added the paintings. I do use this in the winter months. I think I'll be stoking it up very soon because I love it cozy and warm in the morning. Everything was barnwood. You know, you can see the sink is all built from old barnwood. The framework around windows and doors, it's all barn-related wood. Peter loved Shakespeare and had a children's Shakespearean camp on the property every July for 13 years, followed by an open-air performance in the front yard with the castle as their backdrop. He rewrote 2 old movies the last 2 years, 1 year Dracula, 1 year Frankenstein, redialoguing them into Shakespearean lingo by taking excerpts from all of Shakespeare's plays, and he'd do that the months of January. Children would act them out in July. And those were on file with the Shakespearean Guild of England. The castles. He wanted them to be one, and he connected it with an underground tunnel. You know, things started to change here simply because you cannot work 44 years on one project without changing it up enough to make it interesting and to lure you out here each day. So you have a different feeling and flavor going on. The faces, the gargoyle effects are made from pieces of wood he collected. They're birdhouses as well. The ironwork, he made every bit of it up from junk scrap iron that he collected. So we're going to travel through this tunnel and go up into that space that Carl's in it. It's the bottom of an old water tower that Peter purchased. The windows he made from scratch. He carved this Buddha out of stone.
I really can't explain how impressive this castle is. It's
amazing to see what this person did, and to know that he didn't have any engineering background, no architectural background. He just drew it. He dreamt it. He drew it, and he did it using all these materials that he found from other places. And you talk about pursue your passion. This is by far pursuing your passion. And it is such a tragedy that he passed away in the automobile accident prior to being able to see his dream come to fruition. But his wife and son following through to make sure that his ultimate dream did come true. It is truly a stellar place to see and to visit. So before I say goodbye on this podcast, I want to give a huge shout out to some people who took time out of their day to actually head over to iTunes and give Dracena Wines podcast a review. It is people like this who take their time that allow others to find us. So my first review is from Brooklyn Shea, who gives us a 5-star review titled Awesome. So informative listening to these podcasts, learning a little something new with each one. Love the easy way Lori talks and makes it seem like she's in your living room. I have enjoyed the topics and the way they relate to the wine experience. Warnage, 5 stars, so much to learn. I love this podcast because it is teaching me about wine without making me feel like I'm a novice. I'm learning about what I might like to try in the future and also about details about winemaking that are interesting and informative. Over JJ, another 5-star review, calling it user-friendly. One of the best user-friendly podcasts out there. No outlandish, uber-geeked-out wine talk, fun, informative, and natural conversation about wine and the industry. And Drinks Go Here gave us a 5-star review, calling us fun and informative. It's been fun watching this show evolve since episode 1. Lori is really hitting her stride in the show, and I love the alphabet of wine episodes. Great guests and always a fun time. So thanks to everybody who has taken the time out to give us a review. We appreciate it so much, and it seriously blows my mind that people are out there listening to me and reading my blog posts. So thank you very much. And hey, don't forget, December 4th is Cab Franc Day. Check out all the information about how you can celebrate the day and all of the wineries that are participating and giving some amazing deals. We are going to be offering a phenomenal deal to celebrate Cab Franc Day. But until then, have a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks for listening to Dracena Wines Podcast. If you have suggestions of what topics you would like us to discuss, please reach out to us on social media or at dracenawines@gmail.com. If you liked our podcast, please subscribe at iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting program you use. To easily subscribe at iTunes, please go to bit.ly/DraceneaPodcast. That's bit.ly/D for Dracena and P for podcast. We would greatly appreciate you leaving a review on your favorite system. It helps others to find us. Let's get social. Find us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, Pinterest, YouTube, Google+, and Periscope at Dracena Wines. And I am on LinkedIn as Lori Hoyt Budd. Check out our award-winning wine at DracenaWines.com. And remember to always pursue your passion. Sláinte.